we joke all the time about Skynet, but we reject this idea of artificial general intelligence, where Skynet emerges as a thinking entity and then decides to kill all the humans. But I think that the Skynet thing is not implausible, but it's not going to happen through artificial general intelligence. It'll happen through accident. Some LLM generates some code that nobody understands, and that code has the ability to do something to the physical world, you know, whether that's launch nukes or accidentally shut down a nuclear reactor's containment system. If Skynet happens, it's going to be like that, through ineptitude, not intelligence.
Since the invention of the wheel, automation has both substituted and complemented labor. Machines replaced humans at some lower-paying jobs, but this was compensated by the creation of new, higher-paying jobs. In other words, tech workers. In recent years, there has been a desire from certain high-profile tech companies for an apolitical workplace. This in itself is a political act, an act designed to suppress the power of tech workers and reinforce the status quo. They know that politics is inextricable from tech, and now, so do you. Welcome to Politics.
Ray, we need to talk about inevitability.
I agree. There is no fate, said Sarah Connor. How did it work out for her? It's a bit muddled.
In which of the 95 timelines that hit the movies?
Oh, yeah. God. Yeah, I mean, I like the sentiment, you know, which is that we do still live in a world where we control things as humans. You know, that all of these decisions that seem inevitable because we're only little people are made by other little people. Mm-hmm. You know, they're not gods. I want to just start with the concept that we're not living in a simulation. We don't live in a fatalistic universe.
Right.
And I think if you want to accept that, then this is not the conversation for you.
Yep.
You know, I know that people do feel like that, and that's up to them.
Right.
But I don't think it's very hard to reason with those preconditions.
Yeah.
If you accept that we're living in a simulation or that we live in a predetermined universe, then all of this stuff about choices is off the table. And I want to say, no, it's really on the table.
Absolutely.
That technology and policies are something which we can, should, and must deal with.
Yeah. No, I totally agree with that. And I think one really good example of this that we see in the tech industry, you know, among programmers, is this idea that AI is inevitable and I have to stay relevant and current. So I have to just dive into this stuff and use all of the LLM tools, because if I don't, I become irrelevant because, you know, AI is here to stay, definitely. And that frustrates me. It really does.
Yeah. I mean, the basis of that is inevitably two things, which we all know, which drives people, which is FOMO, the fear of missing out, and also FUD, the fear, uncertainty, and doubt of, you know, of, like you say, if you're not relevant, well, maybe you won't be able to feed your family in a year's time.
Yeah.
There's always pressure from somewhere to stay trendy, to stay on trend.
Yeah.
And I think fighting that is really hard, you know?
It is really hard, especially when you have the narrative, you know, that we were talking about last week, where the AI companies themselves are pushing this, like, that, you know, your job is going to be gone if you're not the one wielding these tools, right?
Yeah, that is the essential narrative now. But like you say, this is what we call manufactured.
Yeah. Manufacturing consent for AI.
Manufacturing consent for AI. I mean, you know, this is a bit of a kind of
Chomsky throwback.
But we'll have to put some show notes about about manufacturing consent in the media. But yeah, it's like that, isn't it? Yeah, so the point about manufactured consent is that Chomsky was interviewed about this, and he was asked by the interviewer, you know, do you think that I, the interviewer, am being told what to do by my corporate overlords to essentially stay in the mainstream understanding of neoliberal or capitalist politics? And Chomsky's response was, well, you're not. You're not being told to do that. So that's obvious. You wouldn't be employed unless you were prepared to do that.
Right.
It's a precondition of your employment that you are automatically on that side.
Right.
That's where the filter occurs. And I feel like we're seeing this a lot in the programming world also, that people are employed to be enthusiastic and to stay up to date. And a lot of employers are looking for that kind of enthusiasm. Mm-hmm. You see it in a lot of the adverts, you know, we're a family and you've got to treat us like a family. And somehow, if you're in a family, you're meant to stay at work 18 right. hours a day. It's a very bizarre family, in my opinion. But
definitely.
You know, there are sort of this kind of enthusiasm for being forward-looking and embracing of all change is a manufacturing of that consent in the industry. And it's very tricky to find iconoclastic places where you can say, actually, you know, the mainstream trend is not right.
Yeah.
We work in a programming environment and a programming language in a community where being able to say those things is very common. It's very common. In fact, it's kind of like the basis of this community, this closure community that I'm referencing,
right,
is about saying, actually, the industry is kind of doing it wrong. All this emphasis on programmer ease is mm-hmm. a problem, and we should be looking at simpler systems. And that kind of countercultural feeling is what attracts us to that world. And it gives you permission then to also be more countercultural. And I feel like we need to develop that feeling in the AI world as well, where there should be a place where people can reject AI, say that, no, this is not a good thing. This is, in fact, a very bad thing. And for these reasons, which we can, you know, we're going to be talking all about the negative reasons in this series, clearly, you know. But there needs to be a place where we can be comfortable saying that.
Definitely agree. And, you know, one thing that I find surprising and really disheartening, to be honest, is the extent to which, you know, this closure community that prizes simplicity, that holds up simplicity as the virtue. You know, there are a lot of people in the community who are kind of publicly embracing this stuff. And I find that so difficult to reconcile with the idea of simplicity, because even the most enthusiastic boosters of this stuff are talking about, yeah, you know, obviously the code that it generates, you know, it's not great, but, you know, it gets the job done. And it's like, but this goes against what I thought was the spirit of this programming community. And, you know, one of the people who's been at the forefront of this, you know, with a pretty solid brand is Gene Kim. So he was one of the DevOps movement people. And, you know, I had always kind of respected him as like, yeah, this guy is making a lot of sense with the whole idea of DevOps. All of a sudden now he pops up and he's just totally into vibe coding, and he loves the LLMs, and he's convinced this is the future, and he's partnered up with Steve Yeagy of Amazon and Google and Stevie's blog rants fame. And like the stuff that's just coming out of Gene Kim's blog is like, what is going on there? I just don't get it.
No. I think there's two things that are going on. Number one is that they're valuing certain things over other things. Mm-hmm. And what they're valuing, which is a bit bizarre to me, is stuff like lines of code.
Right.
So they're talking about committing, I don't know, 2,000 lines of code day or something?
20,000
lines?
Yeah, it was something absurd.
It's an order of magnitude higher than one would expect from even the most productive programmer, let's call it, you know,
where productivity is measured in lines of code, obviously.
Well, I mean, this is it. I mean, I was making a joke the other day that, oh, we're back to measuring productivity by lines of code, are we? And I thought this was completely debunked in the 1990s, 80s. I mean, this was always going to be a nonsense game, you know. Yeah. So, but now apparently we're back into it. All that is old is new again.
It's a Shakespeare quote. Yeah. Sounds right.
We like a bit of Shakespeare. All that is old is new again. Yeah, and so people are putting out this idea that, oh, if I can get the LLM to generate something that would have taken me a week to do, then I wouldn't have bothered doing it. So therefore, now I can do this thing. I can make this little side project or whatever, and I can make it happen. I wouldn't have done it before, but now I've got like the superpower essentially.
Yeah. Which is fine for a side project, to be honest. Like, you know, one of the things Gene Kim talked about is he wanted to have this thing that, what was it, automatically transcribed podcasts and YouTube videos that he was interested in and like cross-referenced it and so on. And, you know, and that's an example he held up as, you know, he vibe coded it in a week or whatever, and it would have taken him, you know, forever to do it otherwise. And he's like, you know, look how awesome. And like that I can actually accept. Cool, if he finds that useful and he did it. And but I think the important thing here is this is not production code that has to be understood and maintained. You know, this is almost it's a throwaway magic script. One of these days it's going to stop working, and maybe he can vibe code it back into working. But, you know, clearly this is not how we want to build mission critical software in the real world that is, you know, running whatever, you know, medical hardware or Nintendo Switch, you know, something vital like that.
Standard business activities, you know.
Yeah.
I mean, the whole idea about programming, again, from, and you know, I think what we're doing here is we're at risk of saying, actually, our ability to reason about code is now sacrificed. So the concept of programming per se, actually, of coding as a general skill, is now over.
Right.
And we're only going to have the LLMs doing the actual programming now.
Right.
And it's on the basis that programmers make bugs, LLMs will make bugs, so therefore they're equivalent.
Right.
Programmers will make security holes, and LLMs will make security holes, and therefore they're equivalent. This is an absolute nonsense.
It is,
in my opinion. We make bugs, that is true, on the daily. But if we know what that program does, if we understand
it,
and especially if we keep it simple, then fixing those bugs are often just a matter of someone else reading the code or you yourself looking at that code when you get a bug report coming in. It's relatively straightforward to fix.
Yeah.
If the LLM makes a bug, you can only see it from its effects.
Exactly.
That's the interesting thing about this, is you can say change the behavior. You can't actually look at the code because the code is just a blob, essentially. It's a black box.
Yeah. There's another interesting aspect to this with debugging, is that not only can we, you know, read the code and reason about it, but we also can trace the train of thought that led to that code, right? So that's one thing we try to do. We try and get into the mind of the programmer who wrote that, understanding what was the intention, what was the intention of the programmer. But with an LLM, that question doesn't work because it has no intention. All it is a stochastic parrot just squawking out the most likely thing.
Yeah, I mean, the intention is just basically, all you do is you just keep the prompt, and the prompt is the intention.
Yeah, exactly.
But the thing that's a bit strange is, and maybe again, this is sort of something to discuss, is the prompts can get quite complicated. And
Yes.
They're also, I mean, one could imagine that prompts like user stories or something where you specify some kind of behavior that you want out of a system, where you say, okay, the system should do, you know, when someone comes to the website and they want to log in, they should have their username and their password, and then they should have some second factor authentication. So please make that happen, you know. And okay, that's fine. But if you get the LLM to do that, A, you can't just take those three lines.
Right.
It's going to have to be a lot more than that. And keeping that prompt is going to give you some insight into the intention, but it doesn't give you any understanding of what made the results of that program acceptable.
Exactly.
So then, you have to have the LLM write some tests.
Right.
But then what behavior is it testing exactly? All the prompts are spread all over the place at this point, in terms of like the intention, the testing, and does it matter what language that the LLM writes in, for example? And, you know, people have argued about this, and maybe eventually it's just computer.
Right. Just write me, a blob of binary machine code, and I just slap it on something.
Because could be. What is the difference at a certain point? You know, I think we know that languages exhibit different behaviors in terms of runtime behaviors or in terms of affordances about how things can be reasoned about. So, for instance, Clojure and Java and JavaScript and Rust all have distinct features that make them appeal to different groups or different use cases. But if it's just an LLM, then how do you differentiate between all those languages? Where are the...
I'm kind of
going off on a tangent to some extent here, because people could argue on the other side, well, actually, yes, that is great. We don't need to worry about anything other than machine code anymore. We're back to the 1950s.
Yeah, but why did we move on from that? I think like one reason...
Well, for human understanding, if humans don't have to understand anything anymore, then that's what we're giving up. We're giving up all programming at this point.
And I think that's the thing we cannot give up. So I think what we as software engineers must insist on, and we do today, right? We insist on maintainability.
Yeah.
We have these things that we say, like, code is written for people and only incidentally executed by machines. This kind of thing, where the whole point is that you must write code that is comprehensible by other humans, because our programs, our production systems, they live for years in many cases, and they have to be adapted, they have to be patched, extended, all of these things. And I think we simply cannot agree to give up maintainability like that. And I think this is, I mean, we joke all the time about Skynet, right? And, you know, you let off with the Sarah Connor quote, but, and we've talked about this before, we reject this idea of artificial general intelligence, where Skynet emerges as a thinking entity and then decides to kill all the humans. Yeah, but I think that the Skynet thing is not implausible, but it's not going to happen through artificial general intelligence. It'll happen through accident. You know, some LLM generates some code that nobody understands, and that code has the ability to do something to the physical world, you know, whether that's launch nukes or accidentally shut down a nuclear reactor's, you know, whatever containment system. So if Skynet happens, it's going to be like that, through ineptitude, not intelligence.
I think you're making a great point there, though, because we, on the one hand, we have this guy, Mark Andreessen, who said a few years ago that software is...
Let me spit on the floor here. Yeah.
Yeah. But he said something which was interesting, which was that software is eating the world.
Right, right.
And it's hard to argue against that.
No.
You know, that as a society, more and more stuff is going digital, more and more stuff is being driven by software. And that's why programmers have a jolly nice life, generally. Because,
yes.
You know, working as a... Well... For the moment, let's say up until this year, maybe it's not up, but you know, in general, programming is a more middle class pursuit. Let's say it's a more well compensated pursuit than maybe it should be. You know,
yeah.
I'm not arguing for a wage cut here, just in case anyone's listening. But you know, compared to nurses or you know other people, the teachers, etc.,
right.
that work very, very hard, that don't get the same degree of compensation.
Well, compensation.
It's very hard to compare.
Yeah, but also kind of plaudits or adulation or whatever the fucking right word is. We're afforded some level of esteem, you know, as professionals.
Yeah,
yeah.
But also, part of that is because we're seen as smart people for whatever reason.
Right.
Because we have this, you know, there's a particular type of intelligence that we have that can play a computer.
Right.
And that's not universal, that's for sure.
Yeah.
You know, despite the fact that people think everyone should code, and I'm all for that, most people are going to be limited to spreadsheets and stuff like this.
Well, limited to, but spreadsheets are pretty powerful.
Spreadsheets are very powerful, very awesome, you know, and even many people don't know how to use them. But even assuming you can get to spreadsheets, then that's already very powerful. Yeah. But getting beyond that to actually writing programming languages that make the machine do things, that's next level. I mean, in terms of capabilities, human capabilities.
Right.
So yeah, we're kind of a relatively small percentage of the human population who can be programmers. And because of that, and because software is so, let's say software, it's a kind of, the question is, why is software so powerful?
Right.
And maybe the answer to that is that it gives us the ability to implement repetitive tasks on a large scale. So things like setting, we have a phone now, so we can set, you know, we all have these digital smartphones, so we can set calendars, or we can make appointments, or we can send emails. And so people see on their daily basis that their life becomes easier. They've got maps and they can navigate through the world. We've got FaceTime calls and stuff like this. So people are seeing the benefits of this digital technology, you know, and that's, it's permeating throughout the whole world. You know, it's not just the Western world or the Northern Hemisphere. It's everywhere, this stuff.
Yeah.
So people do see the benefits of this technology. But the general idea is this is technology that we can kind of understand.
Exactly.
And that we sort of can put to some extent trust. Mm-hmm. And we've talked about trust before, but
yeah.
I think trust is key here again, because we're now going to put all of our trust in these LLMs. And I think that's where Skynet comes, not because, and like you say, not because it's got some intention against humans. It's because we're now deploying LLM software in nuclear submarines.
Yeah, exactly.
Because we've got no choice. All programmers are over. They're all legacy.
Yeah, yeah.
If we treat programmers as a kind of bootstrap set of humans for LLMs,
right,
then I think this is an enormous danger.
You're absolutely right. This idea of taking humans out of the loop, what you're doing is you're completely removing the potential for someone's conscience to wake up and say, this is a bad idea. I'm drawing a line here, which I'm not going to cross. I will not do this. You know, going back to something like the Pentagon Papers, right? So you had this insider who decided, like, this will not stand. I've got to get the truth out there because what's being done is not okay. And I think, you know, we as programmers, and, you know, maybe we've talked about this before, that it is normal for programmers, or there's a history of programmers having these red lines that they've drawn. Like, I will not work in the weapons industry, right? I won't work in gambling.
Yeah.
Whatever it is. And for some reason, it doesn't seem that many people are willing to draw the red line here with LLMs, or maybe they don't realize. What is it? What is it about that? Do they not realize the danger, or why are more people not saying, like, nope, I'm not gonna use these things, and I sure as hell am not gonna build these things?
Yeah, I think there's sort of three or four or five communities opinions here. Like you say, there's one community of people building the things.
Right.
Now, there's a problem with that group for sure, because the whole point about OpenAI at the beginning was this idea that AI, the thing we now have for like the LLMs and stuff like that, these transformer models, but AI in general is a dangerous area of research.
Right.
So that we at OpenAI, so they said, so they claimed,
right,
we will invest and develop in AI in a way that makes that AI safe and aligned to human,
right,
to human values.
In the public interest, yeah.
In the public interest and to human value. But again, what the public interest is, what the human values right. are, all of these things are kind of left unspoken or undefined. And that in itself is a huge problem, because there isn't just one set of human values. There isn't just one set of a public interest. And public interest is abused on a regular. You can see this in newspapers or
absolutely
social media every day.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
You know, people will expose the private lives of individuals, causing a huge amount of embarrassment and actual harm sometimes under the aegis of public interest.
Yeah.
So it can be a very dangerous umbrella to put things under.
Yeah.
And a very unsafe umbrella. It's definitely a very loose and flimsy one, that's for sure.
Yeah.
So I think that group of people making that, there's two things about those people. Number one is that there's an incredible conceit amongst those people that they perceive that they are building Skynet.
Right.
There's no doubt about that. I mean, they really do believe this, but they also believe that they, for some reason, and again, I think this is a red line as far as I'm concerned, that they feel that they can speak for the whole of humanity.
Yes, yes. the real Silicon Valley mind virus is that, right?
Mm.
We are the chosen few who speak on behalf of all of humanity because we know what's best for all of humanity. And that is just infuriating. But I think going back to the inevitability, you know, where we started off, I think there's also this aspect for some people working on building this technology that it's like, well, this shit is going to happen and it's interesting. So, you know, I guess I'll go and work on it because like it's going to happen. So why shouldn't I be part of making it happen?
Yeah, I think, okay, if it's going to happen, it's going to happen by people joining
exactly
the teams that make it
exactly
happen. So you're contributing to the inevitability. People join in with particular activities uncritically, unthinkingly. They don't perceive that because it's inevitable, they don't perceive that they have a moral choice to make.
Right, right.
And I think that's a dangerous situation where you're being forgiven
right
by this inevitability. And I want to say, I'm not going to forgive you. I'm not going to say that you're a bad person, but I'm saying that your decision
right
is explicit. It's not implicit.
No.
You're making an explicit decision to join the building of these things.
Yeah.
You're joining the side of the LLMs. You're joining the side of the non-simple world, the anti-programmer world, if you like.
Yeah.
I don't know what term we're going to come up with, but at some point there will be a kind of divide between the people. Maybe it's a Luddite divide.
Yeah.
Because what we're talking about is that these LLMs, they're not intelligent. They're definitely artificial, but they're not intelligent. And these LLMs have some uses. Okay, we get it. There are some advantages to doing it. But if you're deliberately using these LLMs in a way which is designed to destroy programming,
right,
then that's a choice you're making.
Exactly. And as a programmer, I mean, you know, talk about the goose voting for Christmas, right? Or whatever the phrase is. It's just...
But I think, you know, again, it's sorry to interrupt you there, but I think it's, again, it's one of these ideas that people have, and we've seen this in our previous conversations about these CEOs,
right,
that feeling like they can outrun technology.
Yes, exactly.
These people who join these companies or side with the anti-programmer world, they feel like they're going to be safe.
Yeah.
Because they're relevant and they're learning the AI tools, they can basically pull a ladder up, you know. And that's what they're doing.
Yeah, they're building the ladder, then we're pulling it up. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and guess what? There are other people up the ladder that are pulling it up in front of you, and you don't see it.
Yeah.
But you're part of that ladder-pulling team, and I don't want to say that that's a good thing, and I do want to judge you, I'm afraid.
Yeah.
I will judge people like that. We're coming to that point where we have to make a stand against this stuff.
I agree with you.
And I'm anti-LLM.
Yes.
And I'm anti-programmers.
Yeah, there's a lot I would like to dig into here. And I think maybe we should spend a whole episode on this idea of like, how do we talk to programmers, you know, who are not only drinking the Kool-Aid, but making the Kool-Aid. So maybe we put a pin in that and really do a deeper dive on that, because there's a lot of kind of thinking that I think we both need to do about like, how do we reach people who are on the wrong side, you know?
Yes. Yeah.
I think another interesting thing you said there is these tools are useful for some things. And to connect back to when you were talking about non-programmers being able to program, being able to use spreadsheets or whatever, I think those people do get some leverage out of these LLM tools. And, you know, it allows them to automate stuff and, you know, just move faster. And I think there's another thing here. It's like, as humans, is this whole moving faster thing a good idea? And I'm going to just say, I'm going to assert that it's not, that this level of speed is actually bad for us as a species, bad for us psychologically, emotionally, everything.
Yeah. I mean, you hear about people living high velocity lives, don't you?
Sounds terrifying to me.
Yeah. The thing I always find a bit weird is that there are certain people, and you know, we're living in a week where Elon Musk and Donald Trump are having a breakup.
Right. As of this recording. Yeah.
So, you know, it's kind of like, you know, it's a crazy time. Who knows what will have happened by the time this sort of episode comes out. But at the moment, they're definitely on a breakup.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
What I was going to say was that people like Musk especially are apparently CEOs of like 15 companies.
Right, right.
But apparently he's also high on drugs most of the time, and he's playing video games for 6 hours a day.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, totally.
And he's tweeting like seemingly nonstop. So I don't know. That to me is not an appealing lifestyle that he has where...
No.
And it feels like that's... I mean, obviously he's one person. He's like, you know, he's in a very privileged situation, having acquired so many resources and so much money and so much power. But this idea that people want that kind of life, where you've got 10 companies or you're doing 20 things at once. I mean, I personally find it hard enough to keep the garden going and keep the washing up done and actually doing a day's work.
Yeah.
So,
but
the idea that,
do you want to automate your garden, Ray? Do you want to like?
I see robots all around me, you know, with the lawnmowers, the robot lawnmowers. Yeah.
Okay. Well, fair.
I mean, it's that seems like a reasonable use of robots to mow the lawns.
Well, automating drudgery, sure, but I think there's something to, you know, and why is it every decade or something, somebody, you know, has this amazing insight that what we need to do to be happy is be in the moment. It's like, yeah, but we've known that for thousands of years, right? You know?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
The Buddhists were saying that, you know, and whatever, 3,000 years ago. And this idea of the, you know, move fast and break things ethos, the idea is just like somehow velocity is a virtue in and of itself.
Right, right. It's seen as alpha, I think. I think it's seen as a kind of high status lifestyle.
Right, right. Right.
And I think that's essentially the problem.
Well, it is. It comes back to the cult of productivity, which you and I have talked about many times. And I'm sure in the future, we'll spend some time on the cult of productivity. And we mentioned it even earlier in this episode, this, you know, 20,000 lines of code committed a day.
Yeah.
You know, and that's seen as being productive. And all day, every day at work, you know, words like productive, productive, productive get thrown around. And I remember one episode, you know, from my own life, I don't know, 15 years ago or something, I was actually struggling at work to remain focused because there was a lot of stress and I felt like I had to deal with every single problem myself. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I was working whatever, 12 hours a day. I was writing emails at 5 a.m. and committing code at 9 p.m. And one of my coworkers was like, man, you know, we're always discussing how is Josh so productive? But I'm like, I am doing terrible work. I'm not doing a good job at any of these 95,000 things. But like from the outside, people were looking at me as some kind of paragon of virtue because I was so productive. And I think this, you know, it goes to exactly what you're saying, right? That this is held up as some kind of look at how much this person or that person gets done. Elon Musk is CEO of 15 companies. How does he do it? Well, he doesn't. Very he doesn't, poorly yeah. is how he does it. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I think he's CEO by tweets these days of various things. You know, he just speaks to his minions once every day or two to say what he wants to achieve.
Yeah, but we have the shit poster in chief as well as President of the United States who governs by tweet or sorry, whatever they call a Truth Social post.
Truths.
Governance by truths. Yeah. Hey, that has a great ring. Yeah. Dude's got some actually. PR skills.
Well, you know, con men in general have amazing PR skills. And those two are absolute at the pinnacle of con men.
They are. They are. Yeah.
Con menism, if that's a thing.
But maybe to bring it back to where we jumped off into this deep pool, apparently, is we were talking about, you know, what's going on with the people who are embracing these LLMs. And so you talked about the group of people who are building these things. But what about the programmers who are, you know, who are just going all into, okay, I've got to try every model. I've got to try every coding tool. I've got to, you know, what's going on with them, in your opinion?
Yeah, I think it's a bit like... I think you mentioned it yourself actually a while ago, which is like the JavaScript world, there's a huge amount of churn. Yeah. Whenever there's something exciting in the programming world, you end up getting a lot of like competing ideas, a lot of so-called innovations and changes. So everything feels unstable. And some people want to jump on that particular bandwagon. You know, it's all kind of like, it's all rickety and unstable. And they feel like they have to be one of the early adopters. They have to be one of these kind of trailblazers. And that's very common, I think, in across all kinds of technologies. And all, you know, you see this so-called S-curve of adoption, where you have early adopters, and then you have things either go mainstream, and then you have these late adopters, and then eventually you have saturation. Successful products all follow this S-curve of adoption,
right?
Which is, you know, where you get this like trailblazers, then you get the mainstream adoption, then you get. And that's where you get this like small curve at the beginning.
Right.
And then it's this very big leap in adoption as the S curve. It looks like an S because the leap comes, and then you have this saturation stuff at the end where you essentially mop up the last holdouts, the last 10% or whatever.
Right.
So that's why it looks like that. When we're on the very beginning of this S curve, even though I think what's interesting is that it sort of feels like we're at the end of it.
Mm-hmm.
To certain people, because of this inevitability thing,
right?
You know, it's like, okay, is artificial intelligence the new telephone, the new television, the new smartphone, the new vacuum cleaner, whatever? Because obviously we can see those things, you know, they started out early, people adopted them, and then gradually it became a huge market. And it seems like they're wanting, because our digital world is run by a very small number of companies, mm-hmm. You know, Facebook, Amazon, Google, and well, it's just Meta, isn't it? Meta, which own a whole bunch of these things.
Right, so
Facebook, right. WhatsApp, Instagram.
Yeah, it's MAGA, Meta, Amazon, Google, and Apple.
Those four companies. I mean, there are others up there, but those are the four major ones that are driving the technology world. And all of them, Apple is kind of like a bit less in AI, but it's still in recent iterations, it started having this Apple intelligence. So it feels like all four of them are now putting AI like in all of their products and accelerating this adoption. And because they own the market, then it feels inevitable. I think that's why it feels that way.
Right.
Even though, again, I feel like industry and consumers don't actually enjoy their products.
No.
I think there's actually, in terms of real adoption, I feel like the reality is quite low. From my understanding, again, it's a small survey, but also, you know, I watch the market, I read reports and feedback and stuff like this. And again, you're now seeing like surveys of young people who don't even want the internet to exist.
Yeah.
Never mind AI.
Yeah, that's wild. That's wild. What was it? It was like some large percentage of people under 30 or something, or 25, who were asked if they would prefer to have grown up in a period where the internet wasn't available. And it was, I don't know what the actual number was, but it was a significant percentage of those people.
Yeah, it was a plurality, if nothing else. Mm. And what's interesting about it is that the reason why they're nervous about it is because the environment is so toxic. You know, people do feel and are beginning to feel manipulated and harmed by these digital platforms. You know, we spoke earlier about the sort of good things that you can get out of digital platforms, like, you know, GPSs leading you to certain places, photograph libraries to, you know, have memories that are special. So there's plenty of good things about technology. You know,
I'm
definitely not anti-technology. But we see in these social media platforms that a lot of them are being applied in an anti-human kind of way to drive advertising revenue. This is immoral and wrong. I'm not going to sugarcoat that.
It is, yeah. And I think like this is just to drive home the point yet again. This is the Luddite analysis, right? As a Luddite, it doesn't mean you're against technology. It means you're against technology that is anti-people, right? So technology must be used in a way that is actually beneficial to people, or it must be rejected. It must be smashed. And that's where we are with with LLMs, in my opinion, they must be smashed. This is a technology we just have to say no to.
Yeah, I completely agree. I mean, for me, I would probably say that given the fact that the papers and the technology exist, it's very hard to smash it. But yeah. I would say that the very least we can do is put it in a box, regulate it very tightly. Mm-hmm. And the concern that we've all got, or that you and I have now, is that these companies who are influencing the US government are asking for zero regulation across all the United States. J.D. Vance was over in Europe recently telling us that we can't regulate their platforms.
Right. Or else. Yeah.
Or else. So this is the concern, is that regulation inhibits inevitability.
Right.
And regulation inhibits these things. That's what they're against.
I think that's a great point. You know, why are they afraid of regulation? Because regulation is the antidote to the inevitability narrative.
Right.
Because we could make a choice that says, okay, yes. And to your point, I think you're right. It's kind of the genie is out of the bottle. It's too late to actually smash this stuff. But we can certainly reject many applications of this technology. We can choose which applications will be allowed and not.
Yeah.
And I think you alluded to this earlier in an earlier episode. I think you raised the example of research into cloning. And I think that's a perfect example of where we, through regulation, said that certain things are off limits. Mm. We will not be researching cloning of human beings, for example. We are taking that application off the table of this technology because we agree that it's immoral or unethical, you know, would pick one. We agree that it's immoral, and we could do the same thing with LLMs. It's our choice, and we should choose it, right?
Yeah. I mean, I think the most fundamental technology regulations are things like electricity.
Right.
If you're building a house or if you're building a factory or whatever, you need to make that electrical installation safe.
Right.
This is like completely normal. I mean,
yeah.
To understand that technologies are dangerous. Like, for instance, electricity is a technology that we've harnessed to our benefit.
Right.
You know, it lights up the light, lights up our world, has all kinds of nice affordances in terms of computers and technology and blah, blah, blah.
Helps us purify our water, et cetera.
So we love it. We love electricity.
Yeah, we do.
The problem with electricity is that now it's the way of getting electricity, the way that we get electricity is at risk because of the global warming. So we see that, you know, okay, we did regulate the sort of use of the technology.
Right.
And that's good because it made it safe for us humans. But now we see actually the production of that electricity is potentially harmful and potentially dangerous. So now it's a bigger problem that we're obviously struggling to regulate and struggling to get consensus on how to deal with it. But again, the whole point about climate change is that it's not inevitable. We can make certain policy decisions if we want to. And the same thing here with AI. If we want to say, okay, AI is out, it's produced, and how you build your AIs is clearly something which should be contested, and it should also be regulated. There should be more transparency around these models.
And the training data, especially.
The training data and the processes that they use, and that should be regulated. I've got no doubt about that, and I think that should happen. And then the actual adoption of them in particular software applications, that should clearly be regulated. You know, you do not want software written by AIs or by minorly checked by humans.
Right.
Because this is another problem we have with humans in the loop, is that
it's a fallacy.
If humans aren't really driving the software,
right,
it soon becomes just like a box-ticking exercise.
Exactly.
That is rubber stamp the code and passes through. So we have to be, and this is not me making this up, this is well-documented research into even how AI is working right now.
Yeah,
so
exactly.
This is not from the past.
Yeah.
And again, maybe we can find some links to that kind of stuff in the show notes.
Well, yeah, there's some very well-known experiments where they try and smuggle weapons through airport security, right? And they have a very high success rate on that, like 90% plus, because there's almost never a weapon, right? So it becomes, like you said, a pattern matching exercise. And I just realized this is a bad example because with LLMs, there's always a weapon. You're just missing it. So we'll cut this bit. But anyway, we'll find links to that research.
The whole point is that regulating the production of these things is one thing. Regulating the application of them into certain software applications or certain domains is clearly something that we should do.
Right.
And so this idea that we can simply adopt them in our work and use them freely is something which we should be very, very reluctant or concerned about, because they're clearly dangerous, unregulated bits of technology.
Exactly.
And it feels like they have a huge potential for harm and abuse. And I think this is the other part which we've kind of like not discussed so far today. Right. I mean, but maybe we're running out of time a little bit. But the fact that LLMs can produce working code for one beneficial use case is seen to be a good thing.
Right.
But we've also seen examples, you know, just in our sort of friend discussions of AIs cheating.
Right.
You know, saying that, oh, they're not actually running the tests. They're not, because it was quicker not to. Stuff like this, you know.
Right.
So this idea that the AIs are always going to be a net positive is also something which is extremely dangerous to assume and trust that those models or that those things are always a net win. And we saw a very great example of that with Claude recently, the Claude model, Claude 4, I think it was, where there were like a crazy attempt by the model itself to leak information about one of its developers when it was told that it was going to be taken offline. Now, again, this is a sort of edge experiment.
Right.
But the idea that people at the top of those companies will still release those models is very, very dangerous. So I feel like there has to be some transparency around what those models are capable of, how they're being produced, and what their application is before we proceed to adopting them wholesale in our programming environments. So I think that's fairly clear to me that these tools are quite dangerous. And this feeling that you can view these tools with equanimity, that there's a moral kind of haze around them, is a big problem.
Yeah. No, it definitely is a big problem. One of the things you said there that I just want to emphasize, and maybe this is a way to kind of bring us to the close of the conversation, you mentioned several times through that, like what we should do, what we can do. And, you know, I just want to point to an example from the very recent history of the US. You know, you had all of a sudden antitrust regulation came back into vogue, and you know, we started taking actions against monopolies, and monopolies seemed inevitable, right?
Yeah.
Of course companies get big, of course, you know, they control the entire market, of course they then buy political power, of course, until somebody just did something about it, right? And one of the people who did something about it was Lina Khan. And I listened to an interview with her like last week, and one of the things she said, and I'm going to slightly paraphrase and slightly adapt it for, you know, our audience, but she said, where we are is not just the inevitable outcome of market forces or technological development. It's a result of choices we've made and policies we've enacted or not enacted. And we can change that. We can. We must.
Very well said. I think that definitely wraps up the thinking. Queen Lina, you know, for sure.
Well, thank you, Lina, and thank you, Ray.
Thank you, Josh.
See you next week.
Bye.
Before we sign off this week, we wanted to thank everyone who's taken the time to leave a comment, a rating, or a review. Really helps people find the show, and we thought we'd take a look at some of them.
There are some comments on episode 2. JB followed up again.
Thanks, JB.
Yeah, very good episode. I've been skeptical about AI in my industry, post-production. I'm looking forward to your copyright episode.
Ooh.
Right. Post-production, I'm guessing that's some sort of film stuff.
Yeah, exactly. We'll fix it in post, Ray.
Ah, yes, absolutely. Yeah. Yeah, there's no wonder that concerned about that, because there's definitely moves afoot to automate more and more of that. And Chicken Infamous is back again. This time a bit more sedate. Another banger, which again I like. Another banger.
Yeah, we love bangers as long as they're vegan bangers, right? We have a great comment from Oscar. Oscar says, "The only thing I make that's free for robots to consume is a knuckle sandwich." Very generous of you, Oscar, to give that to the robots for free.
Yeah, enjoy consuming that, robots.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Ray, I think we have a few for episode 3. You want to pull any of those out?
Episode 3, which is narratives and narrators.
Yes.
Well, we have one here, which is from E. Susanka. It says, "Thanks for the clear explanations of the different narratives. I was in the dark about this. I'm gobsmacked that the singularity is a thing any decent person would be rooting for."
I think maybe no decent person is rooting for it, maybe.
But that's right, yeah.
Moving over then to episode 3, we have a comment from E. Sadi. A lot of E's loving our stuff, so we love the E's back. "The amount of people using ChatGPT for therapy is scary. There's a lot to unpack about the lack of health support for the general population that leads to this, but it is scary. And now if ads are being introduced, OFFS.
I mean, what can you say? And it is definitely scary. We're going to live through a very difficult situation in the coming years, that's for sure. The fact that we're starting this now, obviously, it's just the beginning of the fight. Things are going to get a lot worse before they get, if they get better, it's going to take a long time, because this sort of stuff is going to unwind pretty slowly, I think. As Chris said, if they're going to start putting ads into these things, it's going to be incredibly difficult to avoid the effects of this. Especially, imagine that you're getting an ad in the middle of a therapy session.
Yeah, exactly.
This is like true dystopia, I think.
So thanks again to everybody who's engaging with us here. It is a little bit hard to follow these reviews and comments across the platform. So if you've left us a comment and you want to just bring it to our attention, we'd really appreciate an email to podcast@politex.dev. That will just help us make sure that we see your comments, and we appreciate it again.
Yeah, I mean, there are lots of platforms, and it's just difficult to survey this kind of fragment. Well, I enjoy the fact that it's a fragmented landscape, to be honest.
Oh, yeah.
Podcasts, to me, the last bastion of diversity, the last bastion of the kind of like real internet. So it's great that we have all of these different players and different platforms.
Absolutely.
So yeah, if you're leaving reviews and comments on those other platforms, it would be really great to hear about them. But obviously, it's very difficult for us to scour that landscape with any regularity. And we're definitely not going to get any AIs to help us.
Why not, Ray? I just... Agentic AI. Go out and find all of the comments.
Yeah.
One other thing that would help us out is if anyone is interested in doing some of the transcription for the show, because that is a process that's time consuming. And we do believe in making sure that our content is accessible to everyone, even if they're not someone who can engage with the podcast in audio form. If you're someone who would be interested in helping out with that, just drop us a line, please. Again, podcast@politex.dev email, or, you know, feel free to send a DM on social media or whatever. We're here for you, and we would really appreciate that.
This is that bit at the end where we thank you for listening to this episode of Politex. First, we hope you enjoyed the show, and we really appreciate the time you've given to this subject. If you want to follow up with us, please send email to podcast@politex.dev, because that's very direct and doesn't have any algorithms. If you prefer social media, we're at Politex on Blue Sky and at Politex at mastodon.social. We're not on Twitter for obvious reasons. To help the show reach a wider audience, please share it with your friends, family, and colleagues. There's nothing as good as a real human recommendation. You can find out more about the show on the website, which is politex.dev. As you should expect, There are no cookies or tracking of any kind. All the show notes, transcripts, and contact details are over there. If you want to show a deeper level of commitment, there's also an option to donate. We're passionate about free and open access to the episodes, so there's no obligation and there are no benefits other than a warm feeling in your heart. Finally, we would really appreciate a 5-star review on your podcast platform. Reading positive reviews makes us feel good and can help others find the show and make them feel like it's worth their time. Okay, that's all the admin done, and we hope to see you next week. Bye!